There's this persistent, almost cinematic stereotype we deal with when we talk about autism. It's the Rain Man trope, or, maybe the Sherlock Holmes type.
The brilliant but solitary genius.
Exactly. The
Yeah.
one who treats other human beings like furniture. The assumption is that because the social skills are different, the desire for connection just isn't there.
The robot myth.
Yeah.
It is so pervasive, and honestly, it's one of the most damaging narratives out there.
Why do you say that?
Because if you assume a whole population doesn't want connection, you stop building bridges to them.
Yeah.
You leave them on the island.
Which is exactly why we're looking at this today. We're doing a deep dive into a guide called Autism and Building Healthy Relationships.
A fantastic resource.
And the very first thing that jumps out from this text is this massive correction to that myth, the desire to be understood, to be valued, to have a partner. That is not a neurotypical thing.
No, that is human. It's universal. The source makes it so clear. The disconnect isn't a lack of desire. It's a difference in the operating system used to get there.
Yeah.
But we have to be honest about the cost of this disconnect.
Right.
We aren't just talking about, awkward silences at dinner parties. We are talking about profound isolation.
The stats in here were actually, they were pretty staggering. I had to stop reading for a second when I hit the marriage rate.
You're referring to the 9% figure.
Yeah. Approximately 9% of the autistic population gets married compared to what, about 50% of the general population?
That's right.
That is a massive gap. And my first thought was, okay, is that by choice? But the source implies it's really not.
In the vast majority of cases, no, it is not by choice. That gap represents a canyon of misconnections, of misunderstandings, and eventually people just giving up.
And the health implications of that are serious.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We know that loneliness is as dangerous as smoking, physically, and mentally, it's a direct path to depression.
So when we talk about social skills today, we aren't talking about etiquette.
No, not at all. We are talking about quality of life.
So if the desire is there, but the result is 9%, something is blocking the signal.
Right.
The guide brings up this concept of the double empathy problem. Now, usually when people talk about autism, the framing is autistic people struggle to understand us.
Right. The deficit model.
Yeah.
It assumes the neurotypical way of communicating is the correct standard, and the autistic person is failing to meet it.
But this flips that on its head.
Completely. The double empathy problem argues that the misunderstanding is mutual.
It's a two-way street.
Think of it like operating systems, Windows versus Mac. If you try to run a Windows program on a Mac, it crashes.
Right.
Is the Mac broken?
Right.
No. Is the program broken? No. The protocols are just different. Neurotypical people struggle to read autistic faces and intentions just as much as autistic people struggle to read ours.
But practically speaking, because neurotypicals are the majority, the burden almost always falls on the autistic person to, buy the emulator, right? To learn to speak Windows.
Historically, yes. That's what we call masking, and it is absolutely
I
exhausting.
can imagine.
What this source suggests is that for a relationship to actually work, especially a romantic one, that burden has to be shared. You have to stop blaming the German speaker for not speaking French and
Yeah.
maybe start learning a few words of German yourself.
Let's get into the nitty-gritty of that language barrier then. The guide distinguishes between literal and nuanced communication. And I feel like nuance is kind of a polite way of saying we lie a lot.
We do, or at least we hint. Neurotypical communication relies so heavily on implication. If I say to a guest, "Wow, look at the time, it's getting late," I am not making an observation about the sun.
Right, you're politely asking them to get out of your house.
Exactly.
But a literal thinker hears the sun has gone down, agrees with you, and keeps sitting on your couch.
And that's where the friction starts. The neurotypical person thinks he's being rude, he's ignoring my hint.
And the autistic person is thinking, we're having a pleasant conversation about time.
And neither's wrong, but the interaction fails completely.
It gets riskier in dating, though. I mean, think about a phrase like Netflix and chill,
Oh boy.
or even just, we should do this again sometime. In the neurotypical world, that's often just a polite goodbye. It means nothing.
Correct. But to a literal processor, we should do this again, is a verbal contract.
So they'll follow up.
They might follow up asking for a specific date and time, and if the other person ghosts them, the autistic individual isn't just hurt, they're confused. They're analyzing the data. You said X, but you did Y.
It registers as a logic error.
Or a lie, yeah.
So, how do we solve that? Do we just have to become brutally honest robots? I am attracted to you, but I do not want to buy you dinner.
Well, maybe not that robotic, but yes, the source advocates for what I'd call benevolent, explicit communication. You have to strip away the hint. Instead of "it's getting late," you say, "I've had a great time, but I need to go to bed now, so I'm going to end the visit."
That feels almost rude to say out loud.
To a neurotypical, it can feel blunt. To an autistic partner, it is a relief. You have removed the anxiety of guessing. You've provided clear data.
Speaking of anxiety, let's talk about the physical side of things, the paradox of touch.
Yeah.
This is something I've seen with friends' kids and even some adults. There's this craving for deep, pressure-like weighted blankets are huge in the community.
Huge.
But then a recoil if you try to hug them.
It's the difference between active and passive touch, or maybe predictable versus chaotic. This is really important to understand. Many autistic people suffer from touch starvation just like anyone else.
So they want physical comfort.
They do. But a human hug is, well, it's sensory chaos.
It's unpredictable, right? The squeeze changes, the texture of their clothes, the smell of their perfume.
Exactly. It can be a full-on assault on the senses. A weighted blanket or a compression vest provides that deep pressure, which is incredibly calming to the nervous system without the unpredictability. It's safe.
So if I'm the partner of an autistic person and I'm a hugger, that's a tough rejection to take. It feels so personal.
It feels like, get away from me. But the source really emphasizes that you have to reframe it. It is not a rejection of you. It's a rejection of the sensory input.
Okay, so what's the workaround?
Negotiation. Maybe they can't handle a light, tickly caress on the arm, but they love a firm, strong squeeze on the shoulder.
You have to literally map out the safe zones.
You do. And you have to expand your definition of what affection even looks like.
What do you mean?
If you were waiting for a neurotypical display of romance, you know, flowers, unprompted hugs, staring into each other's eyes, you might completely miss the fact that they are shouting, "I love you," in their own language.
The source brought up info dumping as a love language, which, I mean, I think is beautiful, but let's be real for a second.
It can be a challenge.
Yeah.
It can be really hard to be on the receiving end of a, you know, a 45-minute monologue about the history of the steam engine.
It requires patience, absolutely. But shift your perspective for a second. For many autistic people, their special interest is their safe place. It's where they feel most competent, most alive.
Okay.
If they start sharing that with you, they are inviting you into their sanctuary. They're giving you the most valuable thing they have, their knowledge and their focus.
So when they start talking about train schedules, the subtext is, "I trust you with this."
Ideally, yes. And there was also parallel play or parallel activity. This is huge.
Being alone together.
Yes. You're reading on the sofa. They're building a Lego set on the floor. No talking, no eye contact. But you are sharing the space.
That's intimacy.
For an autistic person who finds social interaction draining, allowing you into their bubble while they recharge is a massive sign of intimacy.
I don't like that. It's intimacy without the performance. But this all assumes you're already in a relationship. The step before that, finding the person, is where a lot of people get stuck. The guide had this term I liked, the cheat code.
Shared interests.
Yeah.
It sounds so obvious, but for this population, it is the golden key.
Because it removes the small talk.
It creates a triangle. Instead of me looking at you and you looking at me, which is really high pressure, we are both looking at the third point of the triangle, the hobby.
The model plane, the coding project, the gardening.
It dilutes the intensity, yeah. And it provides a script. If we are at a gardening club, I don't have to wonder, what do I say to him? I know what to say. That is a nice petunia. The structure is built in.
The source mentions that we need to practice this, though, like literally rehearsing it.
Role playing. It's incredibly effective. If you're a parent or even a friend helping out, you run the simulation. Okay, you're at the comic book store. Someone reaches for the same issue as you. What do you say?
You build the decision tree before the crisis happens.
Right, because in the moment, anxiety can cause a total system freeze. If the script is already in their head, they can just hit play.
Okay, I do want to move to what might be the darkest part of the guide, but it's arguably the most important.
I agree.
We've talked about how literal thinking can cause, you know, some awkwardness.
Right.
But the source warns that it can also make autistic people incredibly vulnerable, dangerous targets for manipulation.
Yes. This is the section on safety and dating. We really need to sit with this for a minute.
Okay.
There's a tendency in many autistic individuals to have a truth bias.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say exactly what they mean, they assume others are doing the same.
They operate on the assumption that the data coming in is accurate.
Correct. So Consider the world of online dating. If a profile says, "I'm a successful businessman looking for love," the literal brain accepts that as a fact, just like the sky is blue.
Wow.
They might not pick up on the subtle incongruities, the grammar mistakes, the request for money, the moving too fast, that a neurotypical person calls red flags.
The red flags look just like regular flags to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A catfisher or a scammer relies on emotional manipulation. They say, "I love you so much, I'd never felt this way before," after 2 days.
A neurotypical person would think, "Whoa, creepy, slow down."
But an autistic person might think, "Oh, good, they love me. That is a factual statement. Now I must reciprocate."
That is terrifying. Because it's not just about money, it's about abuse.
Yes.
It's about ending up in controlling relationships because you didn't see the trap closing.
It is. The source is very firm on this. Caregivers cannot just hope for the best. You have to teach safety rules explicitly, almost like you teach traffic safety.
So if someone asks for money, the answer is no.
Yes. If someone tells you to keep a secret from your parents, that is a bad person.
Yeah.
You can't rely on their gut feeling because the gut is calibrated differently.
You have to replace the gut feeling with a checklist.
You do. We talked about green flags versus red flags.
Yeah.
You literally had to write them down. Green flag, they respect when I say no. Red flag, they make me feel guilty for spending time with my family.
This circles back to the post-game analysis technique the guide mentions. I loved this idea for parents.
It's so useful.
You don't interrupt the date, but you debrief afterwards.
Right. Treat social interactions like a science experiment. You come home and you analyze the data. How did that go? Did you notice when he looked at his watch? What do you think that meant?
It turns the confusing parts of socializing into a puzzle to be solved.
And it's non-judgmental. It's not, "You messed up." It's, "What cues did we miss and what can we look for next time?" It builds that social pattern recognition over time.
There's one more layer to this vulnerability, though, and that's the internal side. The guide talks about self-worth as a defense mechanism.
Is the ultimate shield. If you grow up hearing, even implicitly, that your way of being is wrong, that you're broken or that you're a burden, your self-esteem hits rock bottom.
And if you think you're broken,
you accept broken relationships. You accept mistreatment because you think, "Well, I'm lucky anyone tolerates me at all."
That breaks my heart. I'm lucky anyone tolerates me.
It's a common internal monologue. So the most protective thing we can do as parents, partners, friends, is to reinforce the idea that they are different, not inferior.
You have to validate their reality.
Yes. It is okay that you need to leave the party early. It is okay that you don't like hugs. You have value exactly as you are.
That empowers them to set boundaries, to say, "No, I don't like how you're treating me."
Precisely. Boundaries require confidence. You can't defend a house if you don't think it's worth living in.
That is a powerful way to put it.
One thing we skipped over that connects to this is the social battery. We have to respect the biological cause of socializing. For an autistic person, navigating a neurotypical world is like driving a car in a lower gear. The engine is revving high all the time just to keep up.
Just processing the lights and sounds, let alone the French versus German translation we talked about.
Yes. So when they come home and go straight to their room and put on noise-canceling headphones, that isn't an insult to the family.
That's engine maintenance.
It is. If you force them to come down and be part of the family right then, you are pushing them toward a meltdown.
And that meltdown isn't a tantrum. It's a system crash.
It is a system crash.
Yeah.
So respecting that solitude is actually a form of love. It's saying, "I see how hard you are working and I want you to rest."
We've covered a lot of ground here. We've gone from the robot myth to the double empathy problem, looking at how to translate affection and the serious dangers of literal thinking in a deceptive world.
It's a complex landscape.
Hmm.
But if I had to boil the source material down to one thesis statement, it would be this. Connection is a skill, not a magic trick.
Hmm.
It can be learned, it can be adapted, and it can be built. But it requires the blueprints to be visible to both sides.
It requires us, the neurotypicals, to stop waiting for them to become normal and start meeting them halfway.
The source ends with a sentiment I really appreciate. It says that true connection isn't about fitting in. Fitting in is acting. Connection is being understood.
And you can't be understood if you are hiding who you are.
Exactly. That's the takeaway. And for the listeners who might be in a relationship with an autistic person or raising one, remember that success doesn't have to look like a sitcom.
Right.
It doesn't have to be big parties and constant chatter. Success is safety. Success is a shared understanding. Success is looking at that person and knowing they feel valued, even if they never look you in the eye to say it.
I want to leave everyone with a challenge this week. We often think about how hard it is for autistic people to learn our rules, but I want you to think about your own rules. How many social norms are you holding on to, like requiring eye contact to feel heard, or needing a vocal greeting to feel respected, that might actually be blocking you from seeing the genuine affection someone is trying to show you?
That's the question. Are you missing the signal because you're only listening for one specific frequency?
Something to think about. Thanks for deep diving with us. We'll see you next time.